We're in the middle of a mini-series entitled Portrait of a Prophet. As we're looking at the book of the prophet Ezekiel just now on these Sunday mornings, we began last Sunday. I wasn't with you then, I was having my Easter break, but I listened to the tape recording of Ian Bentley preaching a most helpful start for our series on Ezekiel chapter 1 as the vision is unfolded for the prophet. And today we come to chapter 2 and 3. And really the portion of the exposition I want to concentrate on is those parts we had in the reading. So chapter 2, really verse 8 through to chapter 3. And especially chapter 3, verse 1 to 3. And he said to me, Son of man, eat what is offered to you. Eat this scroll and go speak to the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth and he gave me the scroll to eat. And he said to me, Son of man, eat this scroll that I give you and fill your stomach with it. Then I ate it and it was in my mouth as sweet as honey. Then jump to 14. The Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness in the heat of my spirit, the hand of the Lord being strong upon me. And I came to the exiles at Tel Abib, who dwelt by the river Chebar, and I sat there overwhelmed among them 7 days. I was in the Louvre in Paris some few days ago, about a fortnight ago, and following the signs that were directing me to the Michelangelo sculptures, I finally got to the room. I gazed at these amazing sculptures of the captives. The captive, the dying captive, and the heroic captive. And I kept thinking back to the man who had made those sculptures all those years ago, back in the 15th century, extending into the 16th century. The man who had painted the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, grudgingly. It was a bittersweet experience for Michelangelo to be an artist at all. And when the authorities said to him, we wish you to do the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, he said, it's not really my craft. He said, can't I get back to the marbles? That's what I want to do. They said, when you've done the ceiling, it'll only take you 40 years or so. So he did it in 4, just to get back to the marbles again. Bittersweet. That's what it so often is. You're given something to do. You do it. Yes, it's so satisfying, yet other parts of you are struggling. So it is with this prophet, Ezekiel. It's bittersweet. He's given something to do. His friends, his Jewish friends, are now in exile ever since 597 BC. Their city has been taken. They have been taken away to the land of Babylon, 500 miles away from Jerusalem. King Jehoiachin with them, and also the prophet Ezekiel. And he's there to be their shepherd, their comforter, their prophet. And he finds it difficult. It's bittersweet. There's a scroll given him here in his vision that he is to both take himself and devour metaphorically, and then to pass on to the others. So as we look at this passage here, keep your eyes on it. Page 730. Have it open in front of you, if you would. Just grab a Bible. Look at it. Much better than looking at me. Look at the passage. Page 730 in the Old Testament section. Let's see what we can learn from it on this Sunday morning about the way in which God speaks and directs and empowers us to work for him. But how also it has a bittersweet element to it. And maybe the first thing I can say from this passage, as we got it in front of us, is that God speaks even in the place of exile. God speaks even in the place of exile. Look at verse 9 of chapter 2. And when I looked, behold, a hand was stretched out to me, and lo, a written scroll was in it, and he spread it before me. Now let's try and understand. The exile in the land of Babylon seems far away from the 20th century now, But it was very real. Such things can happen now, of a whole people displaced. We've seen it happen in our century. In the land of Babylon, it meant that for God's ancient people, the greatest spiritual experience that they would ever undergo was on top of them. It seemed like the kind of calamity from which there is no recovery. Politically, it was the end. Spiritually, it looked like the finish for Judaism. And if the words of Psalms 42 and 43 described the experience of a captive carried off in 597 BC, then they must be typical of the best that Israel was feeling. I say to God my rock, Psalm 42, why hast thou forgotten me? As with a deadly wound in my body, my adversaries taunt me while they say to me continually, where is your God? Vindicate me, O God, and defend my cause against an ungodly people. Psalm 43, for thou art the God in whom I take refuge. Why hast thou cast me off? Slavery in a foreign land was a disgrace for the Jews. And coupled with that was the appalling thought that they were now forever separated from their God. Because right up to that time, the Jews tended to think of God as being limited to a territory. Way back in Egypt with Moses, the escape from that land had as its goal, if you remember, the meeting with God at his special place in Sinai. When Elijah was at his lowest ebb, years later, where did he fly to? Far away to Horeb, to the mountain of God. Naaman, the foreigner in Syria, when he wished to worship Elisha's God, had to take with him, if you remember, 2 mules load of earth, some of God's own territory, you see, on which he could build an altar and make a sacrifice, because only on God's territory could God, it seemed, be found. The progress of God's developing revelation meant that the Jews were still very largely at the stage when their God seemed to be localized in the promised land of God, in the city of God, Jerusalem, supremely in the temple of God, which was situated there. Here they now were, 50 miles due south of what is now Baghdad, by a tributary of the Euphrates, required to till a dreadful swampy wasteland in a very high temperature that business friends today tell you can soar as high as 100 degrees and much more, Fahrenheit, of course. 500 miles away was the temple of Jerusalem, and Ezekiel was still to be required to tell them that even that temple is shortly going to be destroyed. Then comes the miracle. It's a miracle of God's revelation that God, the God that they thought they'd left behind in Jerusalem, was speaking to them here in the desolation of their experience. And so verse 9 of the scroll. I looked, a hand was stretched out to me. It's God's hand in the vision. And the written scroll is in it, and he spreads it before me. Ancient books were written on skins or on papyrus in long strips, with one hand unrolling the scroll and the other hand rolling up the message. And that's what Ezekiel in his vision now sees, this scroll appearing before him. The only difference in the case of God's message is that the writing is on both sides of the scroll, perhaps signifying the fullness of the message, and also perhaps that the messenger of God is not permitted any room on the scroll to add his own message or opinions or thoughts. The temptation of the false prophets always would have been to speak in very different terms to those of Ezekiel. Jeremiah describes such false prophets in chapter 23, verse 23. The Lord said, I did not send those prophets, but even so they went. I did not give them any message, but still they spoke in my name. Here is an unpopular message from the prophet of God for his people. Today we have what Malcolm Muggeridge calls the false prophets. He describes it as the great liberal death wish. We see it all around us, of course, in church life today. Liberals who have lost their anchorage in the firm revelation of God and who have had their own thoughts to disseminate from the pulpit, in the lecture room, in books, wherever. Malcolm Muggeridge comments on the great liberal death wish. "It is indeed among Christians themselves that the final assault on Christianity has been mounted. All they had to show was that when Jesus said his kingdom was not of this world, he meant that it was. Then moving on from there to stand the other basic Christian propositions similarly on their heads." Ezekiel knows that he cannot do that. He can't distort the message that is given to him. It's going to be an unpopular one, but there it is in his vision. He sees the scroll extended towards him. And it's bittersweet, because at least God is speaking. God is speaking to a bunch of exiles in their misery. God speaks even in the place of exile. Secondly, God works even in the process of chastening. Look at verse 10 there. "And he spread it before me, and it had writing on the front and on the back, and there were written on it words of lamentation and mourning and woe." Try and see it, ladies and gentlemen, if you will. This company of Jewish people, displaced along with their king by the banks of the Tiber, looking after the canal system there, hemmed in by hopelessness. Yes, even King Jehoiachin was among them. And in recent times, you know, in the southern zone of Babylonia, the archaeologists have found duty rosters and lists of those people who were entitled to receive rations from the royal storehouse. And King Jehoiachin's name features in those lists for the years 595 to 570. So it's amazing what a little research can show up. They were there, all right. They were there. And God's working among them. So what could they do? How were they to survive philosophically and spiritually in the situation of forced labor that was theirs? Well, they did what wartime internees did during World War II. They looked among themselves to see if there were any padres present. The odd dog collar who could put on a service and organize a bit of a sermon. And God saw to it that Ezekiel was there. It was the most depressing, the most chastening period in all of Jewish history. But even in the worst time of spiritual turmoil, there's help at hand. True, the message was going to get worse before it got better. But if we were asked to summarize in one phrase the message of the whole of Ezekiel, it would be the glory of God. That's what's at the end of it. That is what is behind it. That's what it was all to lead to. God was working even in the midst of the dark experience. Augustine of old has commented, "Adversities are to prove and to improve us." Solzhenitsyn, speaking at the graduation ceremonies at Harvard University, declared some years ago, "Should someone ask me whether I could indicate the West as it is today as a model to my country, frankly, I would have to answer negatively." Then he goes on, "Through intense suffering, our country has now achieved a spiritual development of such intensity that the Western system in its present state of spiritual exhaustion does not look attractive. A fact which cannot be disputed is the weakening of human beings in the West, while in the East they are becoming firmer and stronger." So God is speaking, but with a view to ultimate help for these who were captives in Babylonia. The day would come, 30 years after the last of Ezekiel's utterances, when Cyrus of Persia would take Babylon, he would liberate the Jews and make a return from exile possible. Now, no longer would the Jews have political independence when they did get back again to their land. But that would mean that a new spiritual emphasis would surface, so that the people who went into exile as a nation could at least return as a church. That seems to have been God's purpose in this great prophecy, to help the captives, the exiles, in their terrible state, speaking to them of doom, desolation, woe. Jerusalem's temple was shortly going to be ruined. It had to get worse before it got better. But God is speaking, even in the place of exile. God is working, even in the process of chastening. Thirdly, God satisfies, even in a message of bitterness. So look at chapter 3, verses 1 to 3 again. He says to me, "Son of man, eat what is offered to you, eat this scroll, and go and speak to the house of Israel." So I opened my mouth, and he gave me the scroll to eat. The end of verse 3, "Then I ate it, and it was in my mouth as sweet as honey." Ezekiel is required to consume the message and appropriate it, absorb it personally, before it can be imparted to anybody else. There is this bittersweet aspect about the prophetic messenger of God. It is a bitter message. Look at verse 14. As we read that the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness in the heat of my spirit. And yet the receiving and the devouring of God's words comes as a sweetness to this messenger, because it is God who's speaking. Always it is so. Even if the message of God seems hard and stern, once we recollect it is God, the God of all the universe, who's saying this to me, it's palatable, after all. Jeremiah 15, verse 16. "Thy words were found, and I ate them, and thy words became to me a joy and the delight of my heart." And yet Jeremiah's was, if you remember, very largely a message of coming judgment. "How sweet are thy words to my taste," we read in Psalm 119, verse 103. "Sweeter than honey to my mouth." It's not that everything that God has to say to us is like eating barley sugar, nor even that receiving his word is like swallowing a sugar-coated pill. It's simply that when God is acting, intervening, communicating, we know that it is for the best. We know that he has our interests and our long-term good at heart. And that is very satisfying, even in the midst of a trough or a tunnel. So Jesus Christ, in the bittersweet ministry that was his, was able to say in John 4:34, "My meat, my food, is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work." That was satisfying. John the Evangelist, in the book of Revelation, chapter 10 and verses 8 to 11, himself describes being given a scroll to eat, and just as in our passage today, finds it sweet to his taste. But there's also a lingering bitterness in his stomach all the same. So there are times when the message from heaven comes with a great hail and with thunder and lightning, with judgment. But if it's his word, it will help in the end towards his glory. Leslie Weatherhead once told of an invitation by the Archbishop of Canterbury to some clergy to come and spend a quiet day in the country to consider their problems. One clergyman wrote back and said, "Your Grace, in my village we do not need a quiet day, we need an earthquake." God knows that. And this message of lamentation and mourning and woes was the message that God's people needed and had to hear. In the end, it would lead to vindication, restoration, and the glory of God. And so Ezekiel finds it to be satisfying and sweet to his taste, even if, As we read in verse 15, it took him 7 days to absorb and digest what he was required to say. That has happened before. Job had to accept what God was saying to him, sitting alone and quietly, taking it in. Saul, after the Damascus Road experience, before he became Paul, had to be there, just there, blind, struggling, trying to understand what had happened to him. God speaks to us even in the place of exile. God works even in the process of chastening. God satisfies even in a message of bitterness. Last of all, God perseveres even in a climate of rebellion. Look at verses 4 to 6 of our chapter 3 of Ezekiel. And he said to me, Son of man, go, get you to the house of Israel and speak with my words to them, for you are not sent to a people of foreign speech and a hard language, but to the house of Israel. It's very ironic. Many times Ezekiel will be reminded of the truth that it is a rebellious house that he's going to, but it's his own house. Ezekiel is not going to be heeded by and large because they are his own people he's speaking to. It's a common feature, unfortunately, of the scriptures. Naaman the Syrian responded to the message of the God of Israel. In our Lord's time, the Syrophoenician woman outbelieved everybody else with her remark about the crumbs that fell from the master's tables. Jesus said that in all Israel, he'd never found such a faith as he did in the Roman centurion at Capernaum. In the judgment, the heathen cities of Tyre and Sidon and even Sodom will come out better, according to Christ, than the towns he'd visited himself at Chorazin and Bethsaida and Capernaum. And now by the river Chebar, Ezekiel, God's chosen messenger, would be ignored by all but a few. We might well say to ourselves, listening and thinking about this, why did God, who wants to bless the world, persevere with a people who so persistently refused his message and his rule? We can only answer that only in this way could even a few be raised to any level at all of obedient faith. And in the end, God only needs a few to bless and raise great numbers of people, of spiritual children. It happened with Gideon and the few. Only a few were needed to accomplish the purpose in mind. It happened in the exile. Only a few would respond to be God's chosen representatives and a remnant out of the many. It happens in missions. It happens in the work of the church today. Only a few emerge at the end of the day when the dust has settled, 10 years after the mission. Only a selection of those who responded are still around, still growing, still worshipping and studying the scriptures. The rest, well, maybe they had a flirtation with the things of Jesus Christ, even registered some sort of decision. But time is always the great revealer. It's only a few who come through. Many are chosen. Many are called, I should say, but few, I was trying to work that out. Many are called, but few are chosen. I mean, that must speak to all of us here. God is going to persevere. He does. Perseveres in and through Ezekiel, even though from the beginning it's clearly recognized by God and prophet alike that as a whole, the message is going to be thrown out of the window. It has happened to Jeremiah before him. It is going to happen to Ezekiel. Almost signally, the most unsuccessful prophet there's ever been. But then the emphasis is upon the faithfulness of the messenger to absorb and receive and transmit the words rather than upon the success of the mission. It's the vision of God that delivers Ezekiel and helps him to stay firm right through that vigil that he was required to keep. If we have a vision of God at all, that's what prevents us becoming cynical when we find the things we attempt don't quite come off. It stops us from becoming cynical and impatient with our fellow Christians when we think we got the answer, nobody's really listening. Or when we're in a setup where we seem to be the only person who has any kind of belief. The vision of the Lord stops us from becoming cynical, arrogant, isolationist, and saying in the end, oh, I haven't any person who's got any sense in this place. God speaks even in the face of exile. God works even in the process of chastening. God satisfies even in a message of bitterness. God perseveres even in a climate of rebellion. And Ezekiel was the lonely messenger, largely unrecognized, and representative of the kingdom of light and truth. He must have felt the same. Many must have felt the same throughout history as he did. Many times you and I will be made to feel by society around us that we've got it wrong and that the others were right after all. We may be tempted even to give up fighting for purity and truth in our own lives because the consensus all around us is that it's going the other way in our jumbled society. It is as we capture again the vision and the voice of the one on the throne and listen again to the message that filters through all of our materialistic environment and consume and appropriate for ourselves the scroll of God's revelation with its bittersweet content, that we find ourselves able to identify with the messengers of truth, even if we're told repeatedly how wrong, how foolish, how outdated or misguided we may be in our stance. To finish on a thought that Malcolm Muggeridge has expressed himself on more than one occasion, I'd rather be wrong with Ezekiel, Dante, Augustine, Milton, Michelangelo, Calvin, and Wesley, than right with Nebuchadnezzar, Herod, Diocletian, Voltaire, Rousseau, H.G. Wells, or Bertrand Russell. Let's pause for prayer. Teach us, Lord, to stand back from the canvas and to look at the big picture again and again, to discern in life and in your revelation and in the church and among our Christian friends how you are truly at work in our world today. Teach us to number ourselves carefully among those few who do hear and respond, and upon whom other societies may be built. For your holy name's sake, Amen.